welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello there, Ramona Cobbell here with a book show on ABC Radio National. Now, graphs and maps are usually the stuff of geographers, say, but Franco Moretti uses them to chart the history of the novel, from all kinds of genres, like the silver-forked novel genre, to the military, to fantasy, even the new woman novel genre. But does it help us to understand them any better? We'll find out shortly. And we're continuing today with our first-person reading of J.M. Coetzee's Boyhood. But first, from the Journal of Higher Education. Now, they're reporting that a blogger called Matt Seligman wrote in Time magazine, "It is unacceptable to display any book in a public space of your home if you have not read it." That's his prime directive for bookshelf etiquette. But the American Prospect writer Ezra Klein says, "Bookshelves are not for displaying books you've read. Those books go into your office or near your bed or on your Facebook profile. Rather, the books on your shelves are there to convey the type of person you would like to be. I am the type of person," he says, "who would read long biographies of Lyndon Johnson, despite not being the type of person who has read any long biographies of Lyndon Johnson. I'm the type of person who's very interested in a history of the Reformation, but I'm not, as it happens, the type of person with time to read 900 pages on the subject." Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? There's a fascinating tension there, and we're going to cover it in the next few weeks. Right, now we're putting on our white lab coats today and entering the world of science to find out how it can help us understand literature. The canon is only one part of literary history. For every book that is a must-read, there are countless more. In fact, the British Library has 17 million books on its shelves. Franco Moretti thinks that the vast majority of books that exist have actually been written out of literary history. He wants to put them back in, and because of the sheer numbers of them, the way to do this, he thinks, is to use science and its number crunching, chart mapping, and laboratory techniques. Franco Moretti has been called a literary heretic for his innovative approach to dissecting the various fashions and styles in literature. He says his way of understanding literary history helps the rest of us figure out why Sherlock Holmes is an enduring detective in fiction, where others of his time gather cobwebs in musty libraries. He's recently published Graphs, Maps and Trees, A Cultural Geography of the Novel, and a short but fascinating book, but he also edited a mammoth encyclopedia of the novel, which exists in English in 2 volumes, but in Italian it's in 5 volumes. Franco Moretti joins us from the radio station at Stanford University, where he's based there as Professor of Literature. Welcome to the book show, Franco Moretti.
Thank you.
Well, before we look at graphs and maps and trees, tell me, how have the natural and social sciences influenced your approach to understanding literature?
It's something that started a long time ago, and basically I like the activity of explaining things. Interpretation is fine, it's interesting. Interpretation basically takes a book, takes a sentence, takes a scene, says, well, this says this, but it actually means that. It takes a set of words and turns them into another set of words, which is supposed to be a more important, deeper meaning, etc. I like interpretation, but I think that the focus on interpretation, which has been typical of literary studies, has meant that we seldom look for explanations. We seldom ask the question, why? I'm fascinated by the question, why?
So you advocate a distant reading of texts. How does this differ from close reading?
Close reading basically takes a text and tries to emphasize what is unique to that text, the specificity with which it uses grammar, syntax, relative clauses, whatever. Distant reading takes at times the same formal unit, say relative clauses, and says, well, why do people at a certain point start using relative clauses across the board? It's not so much how Henry James uses them in the first page of the ambassadors, but why a culture goes in and out of certain, of liking, disliking, using, not using certain patterns. So it's, in a sense, it's microscope and telescope. It's like two different modes of looking at the world.
But you don't think we should give up on close reading, do you?
Yes, I do. I think, it's different. I think that 99.9% of literary scholars do close reading anyway, so...
So what you think isn't going to matter for them. They're going to keep doing it,
exactly,
you're saying.
Exactly. So I may as well say that we should give up, because we're not.
Oh, I see. But you really think they shouldn't do it?
No, I really think I don't care what people who do close reading do. They do it well, fine, good. What I really would like is for other approaches to gain right of citizenship, which right now they don't really have.
All right. So you say your approach is experimental. So how do we understand this idea of experimental? I mean, we're used to the idea of starting with a hypothesis and looking for falsifiable results coming out of science. But is that what you mean by experimental in literary analysis?
Except that it's very difficult to imagine such experiments as yet. Here at Stanford, there is now a little group, just started a few months ago, mostly grad students and a couple of professors, including myself. And this is exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to look at, for instance, there's one grad student who's interested in, say, how the author in 19th century narrative, George Eliot, say, how the author intervenes in the story and passes ethical judgment. And so we're trying to construct a little model of how ethical judgment is conveyed. What are the signals in when you read a novel, the signals that tell you this is now an ethical judgment, and then run an experiment. Do they change? How do they change? Do they become more explicit, less explicit, more strict, less strict, in which ways, and so on?
Gee, this begs a lot of questions, doesn't it, about how one can define what an ethical judgment is in a
Absolutely.
Story.
Absolutely. It does. It begs a lot of questions. It's not that people who do other things with literature don't beg these questions. It's not that people who do close readings don't say at a certain point, the ethical judgment implicit in this passage, et cetera, et cetera. What this method would force us to do is to say something like this. Look, by ethical judgment, we mean this. Sentences that follow this and this and this rule. For instance, A, B, C, D, four statements. So in a sense, what the method would force us to do would be to put our cards on the table and say, well, this is our starting point and these are the results that we got beginning with our starting point. Of course, people could say, oh, but your starting point is wrong. Mm. And if they have a good argument that the starting point is wrong, we're not stupid. If the point of the whole thing is precisely falsifiability, so if someone were to tell me, but look, you completely misunderstood the way Eliot passes ethical judgment, I'm perfectly willing to revise the judgment. In fact, that's the whole freedom of this, that one can say, hey, I was wrong yesterday, I'm right today, or whatever.
You hope.
You hope, yeah, well.
But, okay, so if you're a scientist, you're looking for, you're looking for laws of the universe, or you're looking for predictable laws, and you can say, this is what I think is happening. Is that what you're looking at? Are you looking at the laws of literature?
Yeah, but not predictive, though. Like most historians, you can't really predict the future, but you can find some regularities in the past and some reasons why those regularities occur. That would be the ideal.
Now, how does this fit in with I believe you're a Marxist, you're still a Marxist. Is that right?
Yes. Kind of a little odd, but yes.
You're an odd Marxist. So how does your approach to literature fit in with your ideas of your Marxist ideas about predicting what the patterns in history, the inevitabilities of collapses of capitalism, etc. These are the ideas that we're kind of familiar with.
Well, of the claim by Marxism of being a science of society, prediction about the future of society has always been, for me, the least significant aspect. It's more the explanation of the past and present that I think is the true mark of a scientific approach. In that respect, historical materialism is another term for the enterprise, and you know, it's to explain history in a materialistic way without having recourse to intention, or having recourse to intention as little as possible.
All right. Well, let's now take our microscope to you and look at some of these examples. Let's look at graphs. Your book, Graphs, Maps and Trees, which looks at how to use these tools to explain literary history. Let's look at the graphs. You look at the emergence of the market for novels in Britain, Japan, Italy, Spain and Nigeria from 1700 to 2000. And we can see certain rises and falls in the market for novels in these particular places. Can you explain what you found?
Well, what I should say we found in that case, because I used data gathered by other researchers, which is an interesting aspect of the enterprise. I mean, it becomes...
Well, that's a meta-analysis, isn't it? So that's common in science.
Yeah, exactly. And but literary critics seldom work together, and this forces one to work together. And I found it interesting as a change. Anyway, what I found in that was that it's usually not a constant, steady growth, but a sudden acceleration that takes more or less one generation. In one generation, sort of the novel turns from a very rare object into a sort of regular literary commodity that can be expected to show up on the market. And then by focusing more specifically on Britain, I realized that it is wrong to speak of the rise of the novel in the singular. Every 20, 30 years, another, as it were, rise occurs. And at some point, there are enough novels to say... to make the novels from the past relatively irrelevant. And so readers of novels that had been for centuries forced to read stuff that had appeared in the Middle Ages can basically live by simply reading novels of the present. And then another rise, and you can become just a reader of historical novels, if you like. I mean, all niches get started, and so on and so on. I mean, it's, the market keeps differentiating and evolving.
So how does it differ from the market in cars? The market in anything, really, that is appealing to a commodity which is new in a market and people's interest in getting the new thing?
Well, cars and cars and novels are novels. I mean, it's just different needs, right? I mean, you buy a car if you need to move around, impress people, show off, like speed, etc., etc. You read a novel if you're trying to find a way to make sense of lifelines and have an idea of style and so on. It's just different needs. But in the last two centuries, both needs are served by a capitalist market. There's no question about that.
So let's look at some of these genres. You talk about the silver fork genre, nautical tales, military stories, and how quickly they can be superseded by new genres. But what is a silver fork novel, by the way?
Silver fork novels, or that's one of the etiquettes by which they go, one of the labels, or tales of fashionable life. They were basically stories of West End high society that, you know, flourished in the first quarter of the 19th century, more or less. I mean,
so are you saying that the novel exhausts its social function and then it's taken up, the place is taken up by other kinds of genres? And
then,
correct. And in other places, the novel that has lost its interest for one group is taken up in another place because it's historically relevant for that particular place?
That would have been my initial explanation. Then when looking at the data, I realized that maybe the real explanation is generational. I mean, every between 20 and 30 years, a generation of readers comes to the fore, starts reading in earnest, probably when they're in their 20s, I assume. And this generation usually wants its own or creates a situation in which new types of novels can be tried. And so a new set of genres comes into being. And, you know, it's simply because the new generation refuses what the old generation was reading. It's not a great explanation, but it's the only explanation I can find.
All right. Well, let's look at maps then. You posed the question in your book about literary maps, and I just should say I'm speaking with Franca Moretti, who's professor of literature at Stanford University and who applies ideas in science to the history of the novel. You ask what exactly literary maps can do that can't be done with words. And you made a map of Mary Mitford's book, Our Village, that looks kind of like the solar system. Certain characters live in the centre, and then 1 mile away a few more characters, and another mile away some more still.
Yep.
One criticism of this kind of mapping was equivalent to saying, well, so what? I mean, how do you respond to that?
Oh, it's a very simple response. No one had actually seen this in Mitford. Once you put it on the page, people say, well, so what? Well, so what? The answer is there is no other genre that actually does this. There is no other genre, narrative genre that I know that functions with a center and sort of regular rings around it. We have here an experience of narrative and hence of time, which has no equivalent in at least all the novelistic genres I know, an experience which has such a strong, resistant center. So, you know, it's the map shows that these type of novels, of stories, village stories, village novels, represent a kind of life that no other novel really represents.
I mean, are you saying, I mean, of the five volumes of Our Village,
yeah.
If you look at each volume in turn, the village, you know, is the centrality of the village is becoming less and less important,
yeah,
in each of the novels. And is that supposed to represent what we all, I guess, what we know, what sort of John Berger's novels told us, that people are moving from the villages into the cities, or, you know, moving away from the small arrangements that they wrote about and lived in certain ways? Is that
actually
what you're saying?
No, actually, no. It's not that people are moving away. It's that the action represented, so to speak, are moving away from the village. So the village is no longer a symbolic center for the stories that need to be told. And the reason it's not a symbolic center anymore is that the way of life that it embodied, i.e. autonomous rural communities, is being severely overturned by the consequence of the Industrial Revolution and urbanism.
But we know that, don't we? Yeah. We know that because we're students of history would know that.
Absolutely. We didn't know that that was the case with these literary products. I'm not claiming I'm changing the history of I'm changing the way we look at the history of the British countryside. I'm analyzing a narrative genre. And I'm saying, well, this is what happens to this narrative genre. It happens because certain things that we already knew happened in the British countryside. I'm just putting two and two together.
What about trees, then? In your trees section, you look at Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes detective fiction. Can you describe, firstly, how evolutionary trees that might normally be used to map, say, genealogies, family genealogies, apply to literature?
Yeah, basically what I did, at least, because it's not like many people do it at all, is this. I took an aspect of literary works, in one case, you know, was clues in detective stories, and followed how clues changed. And so I constructed a little tree according to the presence or absence of certain traits from the feature of clues. And this gave results. I mean, it showed that the stories in which crucial features accumulated were those written by Conan Doyle. And so That's how I did it.
But what about the quality of writing here? When we don't mention that at all.
Well, actually, the other tree in the book, which is the tree of free and direct style, does not mention quality, but it does mention stylistic choices, use of voice, of irony, of, you know, collective, individual, second, third person, first person, and so on. So it's not that I don't look at style when I discuss clues, but I do look at styles when I discuss free indirect discourse. We certainly look at style in what we're trying to do now at Stanford with ethical judgments, descriptions, and other things. The quality is a different story. I'm not even sure what it means, to be honest with you. I can describe certain traits that Eliot has and say Bulwer-Lytton does not have, or the other way around, that Bulwer-Lytton has and Eliot does not have.
But what about what moves you, Franco Moretti? When you say you don't know what quality is, I mean, when you read a book that makes your heart beat and you know, and makes your imagination soar, don't you recognize quality from that?
No, I read books twice. The first time I read books, exactly like you say, and I try to be as naive as possible, as impressionable as possible. The second time, when I look at the passages that moved me, that made me muse, that enraged me, whatever, I try to figure out what they are made of. And so there is a discontinuity between, so to speak, the first reader and the second reader, or the reader and the analyst, if you want. Or at least that's how I work.
So books are engineered then?
They just happen to be that way. They're not engineered. I mean, authors usually have extremely hazy and usually wrong ideas about the books they're writing. We have to figure out how they happen to hang together so well, but they're not engineered. In the same way, our bodies are not engineered, and yet they work pretty well.
How do you mean that the writers are often wrong about what they think they're doing?
Yeah, I'm adamant about that.
Tell me. I want to hear about it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, one of the first books I studied very seriously was Ulysses. And one of the first things I did in studying Ulysses was looking at the famous, among people who study Joyce, Linati scheme, i.e. a whole plan that Joyce described to this Italian person, Linati, who then wrote it down, and which was supposed to be how Joyce constructed the Ulysses. It's completely wrong. I mean, Ulysses is not constructed at all in that way. And Joyce was a very scrupulous designer indeed. So if he did that, I mean, imagine the rest. I mean, Conan Doyle had no idea he was using clues. But he was. And one has to figure out how he did. Our brains do so many more things than we think we do. And I think literature is not different from other things in that respect.
So William Gibson's book, Pattern Recognition, where the central theme was the human desire to detect patterns of meaning and the risks of finding patterns in meaningless data. Is this sort of your approach, a case of pattern recognition meets literary history?
Absolutely. My only hope is that when I don't find a pattern, I realize that I have not found a pattern. I mean, I've done a lot of attempts at maps, say, where I've spent endless hours mapping where characters die in Dickens' London novels, and I couldn't see any pattern there. So when I don't find a pattern, I hope I still have the good sense to say there's no pattern.
Yes, I'm just wondering, what experience have you had with scientific education? Have you been educated in science at all?
No. I went to, in Italy, you know, Liceo Classico. I studied a lot of Greek, a lot of philosophy, et cetera, et cetera. Hardly any math, almost no physics. So I'm an autodidact with all the defects, I'm afraid, of the autodidact.
Because, I mean, for me, I mean, it sounds like you've got a very romanticized view of what science is about and what science can actually do.
Why?
I don't know, because you seem to think that this is a whole body of knowledge that will have the secrets of the universe or the universe of literature will be exposed if you use those ideas. But I don't know. I get the feeling that you're trying to sort of hammer those ideas into the literary area, and maybe they don't fit.
Well, maybe they don't fit, but I'm not trying to hammer them. I'm trying to find them.
You've had some communication with, say, evolutionary population biologist who writes in the last chapter of your book a sort of response to the ideas, and afterwards in the section called Piazza. Alberto Piazza is his name, actually.
Yes.
And when I read that, I mean, he's saying, okay, Franco, I'm going to play with you. You know, you've suggested that some of these ideas we might find some sort of common ground. And he tries to describe what he does in evolutionary population biology and tried to sort of apply that to some ideas in literature. It doesn't convince me that actually something has come out of it, but it's a thought experiment. Is that what you're after?
Actually, I'm not after thought experiments. I think that the proof of the pudding, I've done some thought experiments, I've done sort of methodological reasoning, etc., etc. Now, in the next X years, either I, the people I work with, we find interesting results, and then we've proved at least the beginning of our case, or we don't find them, and then you were right. But I think we'll find them.
Well, I'm just asking questions here. I don't have a position.
You seem to. There's nothing wrong in having. Anyway, a lot of
people. I tell you the truth. What happened? I was educated in science. You see, I have a science degree, and I've moved into sort of the literary area. So I've lost a bit of romance for science, and I sort of feel as if I can recognize a romantic when I hear one.
Maybe I have a romantic view. The reason is, I think, we know so little about literature, and clearly the usual critical methods are not going to improve the situation, because they haven't. Generation after generation, it's ridiculous how little literary criticism has produced in terms of actual knowledge. And I think, you know, it makes sense to try a competitor model.
It's interesting because literary criticism had, you know, maybe for the last 20 or so years, been thinking of itself as an art form, in a way. What do you think about that?
The refuge of ignorance, right? I mean, since it can't be a body of positive knowledge, it says, "Oh, we were not trying to do that." Well, we were actually. It's just that we're not very good at it.
So let's now look at these volumes you've edited on the novel. Now, the original volume version is 5 volumes. This is in the Italian. The English version is 2 volumes. What happened in the translation?
Oh, Princeton University Press didn't think there was a market for 5 volumes, and so they bought only the rights to about 30% of the Italian.
So, okay, let's look at this fantastic couple of volumes in English. You've got an editorial board to help you, which included the author Mario Vargas Llosa. But what were your guiding principles for putting this together?
Well, basically, the idea was to have a history of the novel that was broader geographically, so not just, you know, the Western European tradition. It was sort of broader historically, not just the 18th, 19th century, the supposed zenith of the form, and also deeper in terms of not just, you know, the great canonical novels, but also bestsellers, pulp literature, etc. So these were the guiding principle. And then there was an internal subdivision. I mean, it's just looking at the formal aspects, looking at the historical aspects, and so on.
So the book includes chapters on the novel in China and Japan and Africa. Have these regions' literary heritage been neglected from studies of literature? I mean, I know the answer is yes. So how neglected have they been?
How badly?
How badly has it been?
Well, there are different cases, but the case of China, for me, the answer is very simple. The novelistic tradition in China is as significant as the novelistic tradition in Western Europe. So to reimagine literary history, one must find for that tradition, and probably also in poetry and the theater, but I really know very, very little about that. But for the novel, for future histories of the novel that wouldn't find for the Chinese tradition as much room as they have for the French tradition, and more room than they have for the British tradition, would be, in my opinion, fatally flawed, would be ignorant. They would ignore existing evidence, facts. Romantic scientism?
Well, your own chapter in this book is about the dominance of the everyday yeah. and ordinary in writers' works like Jane Austen. And you say that there are only three turning points in Pride and Prejudice and the rest is filler, and yet it's enduring. Now, why does that surprise you?
Well, it surprises me because usually we read stories for turning points, for the unexpected, for the unheard of. And in fact, let me change that. It's not that we read stories, that human beings have read or listened to stories looking for that for centuries and centuries. This is a recent development, and this is indeed a specifically Western European development, at least in the form I described. Then in China, actually, it's interesting. In China, they reached a similar result by a completely different way 200 years before French and British writers did in Europe. This is, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, but the way we read it now, is there's a kind of layer, isn't there? Because we're interested to read about the kind of life that people lived in those times. We're interested in the history, we're interested in the description. Actually, we're interested in the filling bit, aren't we? More than perhaps they would have originally when they first read it.
I don't know. It would be interesting. It's not my cup of tea, really. But if one were to look, say, at the film reductions, recent film reductions of Austen or remakes of Austen novels, it would be interesting to see if that balance between fillers and turning points has been preserved or whether, as I suspect, it has been overturned in the direction of a return to, you know, narrativity, a lot of much more emotional things. I may be wrong, but, you know, that's how I would conduct the experiment, say.
Your interest in the everyday in these 19th century novels in part summarizes your interest in your historical approach to fiction, which is embedded in, I suppose, what we could say the ordinary. What do you understand by that?
Well, I mean, it's in part similar to my previous answer. At a certain point, as narrative slows down, there is more room to describe or to let ordinary life speak. A day, in order to be in a novel, a breakfast, a ball, doesn't need to be an exceptional breakfast or dance or day. Even a day in which very little happens can be in a novel, because in general social life has been rationalized, and we no longer live in an oscillation between the boring repetition and the absolutely exceptional, and we learn to try and look for some excitement even in relatively stable situations. That, I think, is what is captured by the culture of the filler.
So tell me, what are there novels that you reread and reread because you love them?
Balzac, yes.
Yeah, I wondered about
Lost
that.
Illusions, yeah.
And when you analyse him, does it take the joy out of reading for you?
No. But as I said, it's like splitting yourself. One is the reader and the other is the analyst. I can't explain it better than this, I'm afraid, but that's really the way it is.
Well, you've set up this centre for studying the novel I mentioned, and you mentioned at Stanford University, and you have got a group of people around you. What sort of resources do you need to do this kind of analysis in your centre? Do you use computers?
Yes, we use computers.
And so you've got a whole lot of people reading and making notes and analyzing things.
No, no, no. Look, the group I was describing at the beginning is 8 or 9 people. We meet in a room which must be, I don't know, maybe 50 square feet, has no windows. No.
Is no windows important?
Well, I mean, you know. It's not, there is nothing princely about, there is, Stanford itself is princely, but about these little enterprises I am involved in, they're very small scale stuff. Look, I mean, mostly we need, computers now do a lot of stuff. I mean, you need people who know how to use them, which I am not. But otherwise, basically just need some mental freedom and a little daring. We don't need, you know, this is not big science. We don't need cyclotrons. We just need, mental freedom.
Well, you're kind of hoping for a paradigm shift, aren't you?
Yeah.
And what's been the response by others working in a different paradigm?
What do you think?
I think probably they would regard you as rather strange.
Yeah. That's a way to put it. Yeah, they think I'm sort of endearingly odd. I mean, I don't know. So
and do you work on that? You play on that?
No, well, maybe, I don't know.
It gives you a niche, doesn't it?
It gives me a niche. Yes.
And you've got a few students, and
I got a few students.
And obviously, Stanford is prepared to support the idea.
Well, not more than any other university. I mean, as I said, this is not big science. We don't need much. We don't use much. Trust me. Trust me.
Well, it's a very fascinating idea. I'm trying to remain open to it, and I'm prepared to wait and see what you come up with.
See?
The open mind. Franco Moretti, thank you so much for joining us on the book show today.
Thank you.
Franco Moretti is the author of a number of books on literary cultural history. His latest is Graphs, Maps and Trees, and he's recently edited a 2-volume English language translation of an Italian 5-volume collection called The Novel, and both are published by Verso. And on tomorrow's book show, the publication of Wild Swans, the 1992 book by Chinese author Yang Chang, kick-started a full-blown autobiographical genre. They're usually first-person narratives written by women who suffered or whose families suffered great deprivation under Mao. But oddly, most of them are written in English by expatriate Chinese, and critics of the style of writing called it the Nightmares of the Cultural Revolution genre, or the crying Asian woman genre. So we're going to look at the rise of that tomorrow on The Book Show. So join me after 10 o'clock tomorrow. You can hear this program again tonight at midnight, or pod it. That's all from me, Ramona Kov. I'll have a fantastic day.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.